like to welcome everyone out to the Women's Studies at Colloquia today. We're excited to have you here. Just for a few announcements before I introduce our guest today. Next week is Made Over in America, and it's a Women's Studies film series, and it will be down in on the first floor of this building in 1161. There will be some flyers going around, so feel free to take one, and as well as the roll. And then we have our student who needs to make a brief announcement.
Yeah. Tonight, Dr. Chris Foster of the philosophy department is doing a lecture on Mormonism and animal rights, and it's really interesting. It's really good. I've seen it twice, but I'm really looking forward to seeing it a third time. So here's information on that. It's tonight at 7. So if you just want to, like, maybe take one and pass it down, that'd be great.
All right. To introduce Dr. Hudson, she is a professor in the Department of Political Science here at BYU. She graduated with her bachelor's in political science from BYU and then went on to earn her master's and doctorate degree from Ohio State University. Dr. Hudson has researched national security affairs, foreign policy analysis, and gender and international relations, which has resulted in numerous publications, including Bare Branches, the Security Implications of Asia Surplus Male Population, with Andrea Den Boer, and that was published by the MIT Press in 2004. And this book won the Association of American Publishers Award for Best Book and the Otis F. Dudley Duncan Award for Best Book in Social Demography. Dr. Hudson's also the recipient of the Carl G. Major Excellence in Teaching Award. And in 2006, she received the Women's Research Institute Distinguished Research Award. She served as the president of the Foreign Policy Analysis Section of the International Studies Association, and for 8 years directed the graduate program in international relations at the David M. Kennedy Center for International Relations. We're really excited to have her here, and she is one of the principal investigators of the Women's Studies database, so she's going to share more with us, and it's a great resource for everyone. So I'll now turn the time over to Dr. Hudson.
Good. Hey, thank you. It's great to see all of you here. Thanks for coming. Let me darken the room a little bit so we can see what we're doing here. My topic today is the relationship between the security of women and the security of states. Now, some of you may know that the field of security studies is fairly well dominated by men. Let's just be blunt about that. This linkage, or even whether such a linkage should be investigated, has not really come up in the literature before. Now, back in 2001, we began the Woman Stats Database Project, and this project was designed to allow us to investigate that linkage. That is, we did not have the data that we needed to raise the question and answer it. And so we've been working now for 7 years, and it is now the largest compilation of information on the status of the women in the world available anywhere. For 174 countries, we have over 260 variables. And the database is freely accessible online, so that anyone in the world with an internet connection can have access to our more than 100,000 data points there. Now, the principal investigators of the project, three BYU professors. I'm really excited that three professors from three different disciplines, political science, geography, and psychology, joined together with two other researchers at the University of Minnesota and at Brown to push this project forward. And of course, we've had a team of just remarkable student coders over the years. Many of whom have become dear friends. And there's three of them in attendance today, and I want to embarrass them by having them stand up. So we have Sharla Finnegan is one of our coders, and Becky Perez, and Melinda Hardy, and Caitlin Carroll, our coders here today. And we also, of course, want to thank the Women's Research Institute for their steadfast support of this, I think, very important project. All right, to launch into the content of today's discussion, in security studies, we're focused on what are the causes of instability and conflict in the world of states. And there are in addition to the notions of international anarchy, that there is no supreme power that is able to enforce its will upon states, of course, that's been the case for all of human history. So we must look deeper into attributes of states in order to examine this question. The four most prevalent explanations of conflict in the world of states is there's a clash of civilizations. This is Samuel Huntington's idea that identity with a civilization, inconsistent beliefs across civilizations lead to natural conflict and perhaps even aggression. Lack of democracy. International relations has put forward the democratic peace thesis, which argues that it is a lack of voice for citizens that results in conflict, where you have authoritarian rule, where you have totalitarian rule, the citizenry's desire not to aggress, not to go to war, cannot be reflected. And so that would be a second main explanation. Poverty is another. Some have argued that certain states are simply too poor for poverty, for peace, too poor for peace. The idea being that poverty, scarcity, results in a zero-sum game between human collectives. And this zero-sum game, the nature of it naturally leads to conflict and instability. And lastly, notions of ideology, right? That the major conflicts of the 20th century, the World War I, World War II, Korea, even Vietnam, these were ideological struggles. And so the notion that when we speak about the clash of civilizations, we should not only define that in terms of ethnicity, but also ideology as well. All right, now, here we are, the five of us asking, well, heck, what about the treatment of women in society? Why isn't it on that list? And of course, at first blush, many in security studies would say, what do the two things have to do with each other? Right? They're not even in the same conceptual space. They're not on the same planet, almost, if you will. How is it that we could possibly talk about women and national security? And yet, there is a growing, I wouldn't say consensus, but there's a growing feeling, I believe, especially in the UN community, that by not paying attention to women, we have overlooked one of the key causes of conflict and one of the key aspects to resolving conflict. So, for example, Kofi Annan, when he was Secretary General, said in 2006, the world is starting to grasp that there is no policy more effective in promoting development, health, and education than the empowerment of women and girls. And I would venture that no policy is more important in preventing conflict or in achieving reconciliation after a conflict has ended. Okay, so no longer can we say, you know, women divorced from security, right? They're policymakers, IGOs, beginning to assert that there is a linkage. And yet this has not quite infiltrated the academic world of security studies yet. I'm kind of glad that none of my colleagues from the department are here, because it was actually a department research meeting at which I actually got the impetus, shall we say, to write this article. Mary Caprioli was visiting, and we had a department research meeting, and we raised this question. Okay, shouldn't we put the treatment of women on that list as major causes and explanations for conflict? And certain of my colleagues, not all of them, but certain of my colleagues said, well, no, of course not. Just look at the 20th century, right? The lives lost there, what an immense toll. And that was due to ideology, and it was due to nationalism, and it was due to poverty, and so forth and so on. Hi, Mike. Nice to see you. Well, I must admit that made me so mad. Don't tell my department. Made me so mad that I determined that I was going to kind of check the empirics of this. And that resulted in this particular graphic here, which is, let's see, do we have a laser pointer in this room? We don't have a laser pointer. So I will point with my finger and say, on the left with the blue column, you will see our empirical investigation of how many people actually did die in intrastate conflict and democide, right, where a state would actually kill its own people in a genocidal type occurrence, okay? And we put in everything, including the kitchen sink. So, for example, down here you have World War I, here you have World War II, here you have Stalin, and you have Mao, and then for death toll 3, you have all of these conflicts, which you cannot read. Death toll 4, you have all of these conflicts. Death toll 5, all of the conflicts. So every significant conflict that occurred in the world, the death toll is there on the left in blue. However, let's look at what we came up with, the column on the right in pink. Okay? What we give here is death due to the devaluation, societal devaluation of female life. Okay? My co-author Andrea Denbor and I were able to chronicle this many missing women in Asia in the year 2000 in 7 countries in Asia. Okay? Then missing women in all of Asia is the second section, okay, is how many more would there be if you extended it to look at all of Asia. And then our estimates pale by comparison with the UN's estimate of how many missing women there are today. And that estimate is 163 million women missing today. So if we actually put those columns side by side, I think you'll see that if we're talking on a scale of what my colleagues called blood spilt and lives lost, then you have to talk about women. Okay? You have to talk about women. All right. We raised an interesting question. Might the security of women impact the security of states? Okay? Depending upon their treatment, would a state be more or less secure? Now, why women? Why look at women? Fortunately, we have 2 psychologists on our team. And they tell us that there are 3 attributes, 3 markers, if you will, that humans automatically notice about another person. And that is their gender, their relative age, and their race. Psychologists also tell us that race can be erased, okay, in a sense, by crossing race with other types of societal divides to make race irrelevant. With age, we will all someday be another age. We have all been a different age in our past. Okay, so age is not as much of a divisive marker as some of the others because of this. But lastly, gender then remains the primary formative fixed difference experienced in human society. Okay, so if you want to look at how difference is treated in society, look first at the treatment of women in society. Hey, we develop in our paper. By the way, I should tell you, the paper is being published in the #1 journal in security studies and will appear in December, which is, yes. Anyway, we develop a theoretical framework. As you can imagine, all academic theoretical frameworks are long and windy, so I won't give you the whole schmear. If you want to read the whole thing, let me know and I'll send you a draft of the paper. But we fuse 3 different theoretical traditions for our framework to approach this question of women and security. We look at evolutionary biology and psychology. We look at theories of social diffusion from political sociology. And we look at theories of social learning from psychology. So we'll give you kind of an overview of some of the main building blocks then of our theory. From evolutionary biology and psychology, we learned that human social structures are actually built around and, in a sense, reflect human reproductive strategies, okay, which is an interesting thought in and of itself. Evolutionary biologists tell us that there are only 2 species that live in patrilineal male-bonded communities. I don't talk this way usually. Patrilineal male-bonded communities where females leave to mate and males initiate intense territorial aggression. Only 2. Humans and chimpanzees. Okay, that's it. Humans and chimpanzees. Human sexual dimorphism, that is to say the greater upper body strength of males compared to females, according to biologists, testifies to the reproductive advantage accorded to better fighters throughout our evolutionary period. Male kin dominance hierarchies then form and become the natural social unit. Alpha males and subordinate males form this male kin hierarchy, and this is the foundation of patriarchy, not patriarchy in the Mormon sense, right, but an evolutionary biological sense, which is the exact opposite of what patriarchy means in Mormon doctrine. So make sure you keep those separate. Okay, patriarchy then, these male kin dominance hierarchies, are worldwide and history-wide. Okay. Evolutionarily derived efforts to control women and at the same time have solidarity with fellow men in competition against outsiders. So when advisors to the army in Iraq talk about the clan structure of Iraqi society and what can and cannot be accomplished in clan culture, what they're talking about is this evolutionary context of male dominance hierarchies. Okay, consequences then from human reproduction as molded by evolution. Human gender hierarchies are the most pervasive hierarchies then among humans. Right? No matter where you go, no matter what small little tribe that you find on some long-lost island, you will still find gender hierarchies. You will also find a remarkable convergence in family law. Again, no matter what continent you're looking at, no matter what time period you're looking at, family laws that say adultery is much more of a crime for women than for men, that divorce should be easy for men, but very, very difficult for women, that custody of male children belongs to men, right? That inheritance should be passed through the male line, not the female line. I could go on and on. In fact, we've just done a paper on this remarkable convergence in family law. Changes in female evolution, okay, where in fact in societies, female fetuses may be affected in the womb, right, by the hormones that their mothers are feeling. And if their mothers are living in a male dominance hierarchy, then the female fetus is likely to be affected by the hormonal state of her mother. Aggression against outgroups through male coalitional violence, right? The idea that male coalitions, clans if you will, okay, discover how cheap and easy it is to gain resources far above what they could produce themselves by engaging in coalitional aggression. And of course, evolutionary biologists tell us that political power in our evolutionary past originated from physical domination in male dominance hierarchy. All right, let's turn to sociology then and talk about some social diffusion theories. Okay, gender hierarchy, yes, is enforced by actual dominance, okay, but violence also becomes the social template for the treatment of all differences in society. Outgroups become, quote unquote, feminized, treated as if they were women, dominated, marginalized, because they are cast in the role of female to the main culture's maleness. Structures then begin to emerge to make domination of females easy. Okay, so polygamy, very early marriage for women, age 14, 15, 16, patrilocality, where the girl moves to her husband's household, and overt sanction of domestic violence in culture. These types of structures begin to infect all social institutions. Domination and cultural violence begin to appear normal. Gender hierarchy then provides the justification for violent dominance-based templates of nationalism, aggression, use of force, and of course, conflict resolution by domination. Okay, now, social learning theory from psychology also gives us some insights as well. That is to say that this doesn't just come with our genes, right? That individuals have to be socialized. They have to learn that these templates exist and that these templates are functional. So individuals are socialized within the family and society that violence is functional. It works. And here is where you see cultural selection as versus natural selection at work. Violence must be learned. Bonnie Battle Spanville, who couldn't be here today, has shown that boys are not more violent than girls. Okay? Male-bonded groups, however, are very likely to form. Males bond much more readily together than females bond together. This may come as news to some of you, but that's what psychologists tell us. Male-bonded groups form in society, acquire power, and define themselves as dominant first in their relationship to women. Okay? My kids love to watch The Little Rascals, and of course The Little Rascals form the He-Man Woman Haters Club as sort of their first foray into this. Calvin, of course, was it get rid of slimy girls? Gross. Men in these societies then may be committing daily acts of aggression and violence in their home or in their relationship with women. This overlearned behavior then, according to psychologists, becomes automatic and then is extended, right, to behavior in broader spheres of society, so outside the home as well. Now, lest you think that I'm suggesting that somehow this is all inevitable, I want you to understand that it's not. Neither biologists, nor sociologists, nor psychologists believe that this is inevitable. Evolutionary forces can be counteracted, can be checked. If gender violence is not modeled, not reinforced, if it is actively punished, its incidence can be severely limited. If gendered violence can be stopped at its taproot in the home, that change will cascade outward from the home to the larger society and the state. Okay, so here's our research question. Does the mitigation of gender violence, right? Now that indicates that the society is out there proactively trying to counteract evolution. So does the mitigation of gendered violence then mitigate conflict within and between states? Okay, so is this notion that if you turn off the taproot, that will cascade outward, right, and mitigate violence at other levels, including the state level? Does that hold or not? Now, there were some existing findings that led us to believe that we were not on a wild goose chase. Steve Fish out at Berkeley found that Islamic societies were not more authoritarian or involved in conflict than other nations. Okay, but what he did find is that the treatment of women in Islamic societies correlated very highly with the level of authoritarianism in that society. Mary Caprioli, one of our PIs in previous work before she joined our project, showed that states with higher levels of gender equality are less likely to use force, likely to use lower levels of aggression when using force in both interstate and intrastate conflicts. Rose McDermott, she's an experimental psychologist and part of our team. In previous work, she has shown that men are much more likely to use unprovoked aggression as a strategy in simulations. And Engelhard and Norris, Engelhard out at Michigan with the World Value Survey, a very extensive instrument to look at almost 70 different societies and survey them on a variety of attitudes, and they do this every 2 years. What they found is that political beliefs, such as beliefs about the desirability of democracy, did not vary across cultures that they surveyed. The biggest difference that they found between cultures was actually beliefs about women. Okay, beliefs about women. Okay. So in order to address this question, we first had to operationalize some of our variables. We wanted to have an indicator of the physical security of women, all right, in all the various nations of the world. Such an index does not exist, so we had to create one. Using the Woman Stats database, this fantastic new resource, we were able to construct a scale, a cross-national scale, of violence against women. I believe I've talked to you about the parameters of the Woman Stats database already. All right, for our dependent variables then, we're interested in looking at indicators that would show us the degree of violence between and within states. And so we looked at the Global Peace Index by the Economist Intelligence Unit, the EIU. We also used a scale developed by one of our students, the States of Concern to the International Community Scale, which measures how compliant the state is with international treaty and covenant obligations to which they have signed up. And then a scale of relations with neighbors that looks in particular about relations between neighboring states. Now, of course, we needed some control variables, and we chose those control variables from that original list of what is looked at primarily in security studies. So we looked at level of democracy using the Freedom House variables, level of wealth, we took GDP per capita quintile, and we also used a scaling by Professor Chad Emmett in geography of the prevalence of Islam within societies, okay, to see how these would all stack up together. Okay, now, issues of causality. Okay, at this point, I'm not going to be able to tell you that maltreatment of women causes national insecurity. Okay, and that's because causality is very strictly defined in statistics. So, for example, our physical security women's scale has only one time point. Because there's no temporal variation, there's no possibility of showing causality in a conventional statistical fashion. But there are two other concerns as well. One is if you use evolutionary theory, you might need to have a research design that actually looks at interspecies comparisons. That is, looks at a species that did not take the same path as humans and chimpanzees. And since I'm a social scientist, I'm not quite ready to go out in the field and study gorillas and bonobos and chimpanzees and so forth. So, and then lastly, IR feminists have argued that violence against women and state violence are what they call co-constitutive, right? They're of a piece, okay? Domination of females didn't happen here, and then aggression by male kin networks happened here, right? That they emerged together. If they are co-constitutive, you're going to have a really hard time showing some form of arbitrary temporal separation between the two, especially since our prehistory is shrouded in mists. So at this point, we're interested in association. All right, we did three types of tests. The first, very low-level test, we simply did a chi-square association to figure out if there was even any reason to go forward, right? If the physical security of women was not significantly associated with state behavior, why even pursue the issue? Second, we were then engaged in bivariate polygamous logistic regression, right, to see sort of head-to-head how the various independent and control variables fared in a regression equation on the dependent variables. And lastly, we did the multivariate version of polygamous logistic regression, which allows us then to control for the control variables and see if there is still an association between the physical security of women and our dependent variables, even when we have all the variables in the mix. Okay, I'm pleased to tell you that the chi-square results were outstanding. Okay, at the significance level of rho less than or equal to 0.0001, the physical security of women is related to state behavior. But the control variables are also significantly associated. So let's take a look at bivariate regression. Okay, now this is not multivariate, it's bivariate. Nevertheless, you can see here that we have some interesting results. I wish I had a laser pointer because I'm not that tall. Let's see, maybe I can use my mouse. Is my mouse, no, wait. Yeah, aha, okay. This cluster here is the Global Peace Index, okay? And here's the physical security of women, democracy, where did my cursor go? Wealth, and Islamic civilization. Now, sometimes when you do polygamous logistic regression, it will fail a test called the parallel line test, and the pseudo R-squared value becomes unreliable. So we weren't able to capture wealth for GPI. Nevertheless, take a look. Here's the physical security of women, pseudo R-squared. Here's democracy. Here's Islamic civilization. Now let's look at state compliance with international norms. Physical security of women, democracy, wealth, Islamic civilization. Here's relations between neighboring nations, physical security of women, democracy. He didn't get a result with wealth and Islamic civilization. Okay, there's always this moment before you hit the button to have your statistical package calculate all of this. And when I was hitting the button, I was like, oh, please! And this blew me away. Okay. Now, the multivariate tables are huge, and I cannot get them to fit on PowerPoint in other than minuscule 5-point font. So the multivariate regressions, however, were even more impressive. Okay. The best overall discrimination among the levels of the dependent variables was offered by the physical security of women. In fact, Islamic prevalence in multivariate analysis becomes completely insignificant. Freedom becomes completely insignificant, and the only discriminatory power for wealth is found in the highest category of wealth. That is, the very wealthiest nations have better state behavior. But other than that, no other level of this variable had any discriminatory power. So the result is, from our empirical investigation, if you had to pick one variable to best help you predict the level of state peacefulness, state compliance with international norms, and peacefulness of relations with neighboring states, you would not pick democracy, you would not pick wealth, you would not pick Islam. You would pick the physical security of women as the most potent predictor of state behavior. So let's think more broadly about this, okay? Let's talk about this. Maybe it's time to rethink what constitutes security for states and how security is to be obtained. And we need to rethink this now with women in mind. I think a whole variety of new questions then naturally occur to one. Should we use inequitable family law as a marker of civilization? And what would we find if we did? How does this impact on the issue of calls for Sharia law enclaves in Canada, Great Britain, and Australia? What is the relationship between polygamy, authoritarianism, and terrorism? What kinds of insecurity for states arise from alterations in sex ratios, such as we find in China and India? Perhaps we should redraw Huntington's famous map in which he showed the various civilizations. Maybe we should redraw it according to the treatment of women and see if we have greater insight on world affairs if we have a map that looks like that. And maybe we should look at the average psychological profiles of leaders from states in which women are treated better and states in which women are treated worse, to actually look at psychological predispositions to conflict that arise in leaders that have been socialized in various states. Now, there's some policy considerations, I think, to be discussed as well. If our findings hold, then the status of women may be an integral element of proposed solutions to international conflict. And in fact, I believe the UN is going in that direction. UN Security Council Resolution 1325, mandating that women be part of any peace negotiations, is a step in the right direction. The UN Security Council Resolution 1820, demanding that people be held accountable for rape in conflict, including UN peacekeepers, is a step in the right direction. One of the things that should give us some hope is the treatment of women is amenable to change, right? There are nations in which women are treated better, and they are inhabited by humans. Okay? So it is not inevitable that women have to be treated badly in any particular society. Even among the group of Islamic nations, we have nations all across the board in their treatment of women. And here's one that's rather revolutionary. Perhaps mitigating violence against women would be more effective as a strategy to ensure a peaceful world than the export of democracy and capitalism. Now there's a thought. What would the norms be? Physical security for women, equity under the law for women, and parity for women in the councils of national decision making. And that should be the norm that we try to hold every country in the international system to. So in conclusion, our results suggest that to understand and promote national and international security, the situation and treatment of women cannot be overlooked. And the last sentence of our article is, security is a garment that must be woven without seam. If we are not paying attention, the loose threads of women's systemic insecurity will unravel peace for everyone, men and women. Okay, that's all I got. Thank you.
We have a few minutes. Are there any questions you'd like to ask Dr. Hudson?
Your policy has been suggesting that there is a causal relationship, not just an association. Do you have work planned to establish that causal relationship rather than just
Oh, sure. Frankly, I'm a positivist, you know, as Neanderthal as that may be. Maybe I should call myself a neo-positivist, which sounds a little more sophisticated, doesn't it? I'm a neo-positivist. So I certainly have not given up the idea of looking for causality, because we do have states in the world that are changing their treatment of women. If I keep coding the physical security of women over time in my database, I'm going to get it. I'm going to be able to do it even using conventional statistical methods.
So your PSOW value right now is calculated on one time.
Exactly. Right. It took us 6 years to get to the point where we could code it for 174 countries. But now that we have that coding, we can then update that coding. We're planning to do it every 2 years. So our next coding will be in 2009.
Any other questions?
So you talked about women here. What about other minority groups? I mean, I don't see why didn't this apply to other minority races or minority groups?
We believe that the template for treatment of minority groups is rooted in the template of treatment of women. And if you mitigate this, you will mitigate the treatment of the maltreatment of minorities as well. The first difference is when a child notices that his father and mother are not the same. Right? That is the first difference. And that's where we have to tackle these dysfunctional templates.
Mm-hmm. So as far as working, whether domestically or internationally, as far as if you're kind of on a grassroots level, what are your thoughts as far as where to start with this? This is a very weighty subject to tackle. Where do you suggest starting?
Actually, I think there are so many NGOs that advocate better treatment for women. It's amazing. If you want to go to the site peacewomen.org, you will actually find a list of all NGOs that advocate for better treatment of women in every country. And the list is very impressive. The groundwork is being laid. I think what's new is just within the last 5 years, the UN has come aboard and said, yeah, maybe we should pay attention to the treatment of women. I'm actually fighting a rear guard battle, which is academia always lags. You would think the academics would be far in front of everybody and leading the charge. Well, in this case, it's not true, right? In this case, I'm actually sweeping up in the back halls of academia to help them to catch up with what IGOs and NGOs already know. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't it have been nice if, assuming the invasion of Iraq was inevitable, there was someone advising President Bush that if you didn't have security for Iraqi women, you might as well kiss it goodbye, because you weren't going to get security for anybody else. That would have been nice. I would volunteer, but nobody asked me. Yes?
Dr. Hudson, what is your favorite example of a state or state leader who's made strides to improve the situation?
Oh, gosh. I guess it would be Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia. What a difference one woman has made, right, in trying to turn around almost a rape culture within the society of Liberia. She's, you know, the things aren't perfect in Liberia. I don't think I would want to be born there even now. But to see the strides that she's made there is truly inspiring. And I think Sheikh Khalifa in the United Arab Emirates, she's actually as much of an Islamic feminist as you can get without, you know, incurring some fatwa against her, arguing for her death. And she has done amazing things, setting up universities, women's universities throughout the land that have as much funding and as excellent teachers as universities for men. Oh, I'm sorry. Should I take someone else first? Yes.
Yeah. What will compel or persuade the worst offenders to treat women properly? I mean, the examples of internal, you know, leaders who've risen to the top and done it, but what, as, and we're external, I think America's probably one of the better countries. What can force or persuade these countries to follow suit?
Sending the missionaries? Sending the missionary. Well, you know, that's kind of a glib response, but what I'm getting at here is there's only so much top-down you can do. You have to do top-down, right? Anyone who wants to have better treatment for women and is going to ignore what government can or cannot do for women is a fool. But at the same time, all right, you can argue top-down till you're blue in the face. You can punish people till they're blue in the face, and they will still find a way out of it. For example, in Turkey, right, harsh new punishments for honor killings, right? So what do they do now? They lock the girl in a room with a gun or a vial of poison, and they say you will not leave until you commit suicide, right? Honor suicide. Can't put anybody in jail for that. She committed suicide, right? So I think we can see the limits of the top-down approach. So we need top-down. We need to have those laws that punish honor killings. But I think there also has to be some modeling of how much happier you could be if you lived in a loving partnership with women rather than in a dominance hierarchy for women. So there has to be the spread of new templates for interacting with women. I find my own church offers that kind of template, right, and is actively seeking to promote that template house to house, door to door. And I think that's admirable, right? Both ways. Pincer movement. Denise.
So there is a media community, many of you know it, with the influencer, and it gives a lot of ideas on how to do, you know, exactly what you're asking.
What's it called?
It's called The Influencer. It was written.
The Influencer.
Christian conversations and Christian conversations. And so they have many suggestions that are not only based in research, but on actual examples where people have made major influence.
I've got to go get that.
And modeling is one of them.
Okay.
And the other thing is that you cannot force, but you have to get people connected with your community. And actually give some really good suggestions and examples of how that's done. So, anyway.
Good. Thank you for that.
Any other questions for Dr. Hedgen?
One more. I'm just wondering how you feel about the work that's being done by Central Asian Institute. And
I don't know. Tell me about it.
Well, there's a Greg Morgan.
Oh, Three Cups of Tea?
Yes.
Ah.
It has set up, is in the process of building a number of schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan and working in concert with the people.
Isn't he emphasizing schooling for girls?
Yes. Yeah. And so the purpose is to get education for all, but especially for women.
Yes.
And he speaks with the community leaders previously to doing anything. And so all of the work is basically done by the community with the funding coming from this organization. And so I just kind of wondered.
I'm a big fan. I didn't know he called his organization, the Central Asian Institute, but I've been following him from the beginning, and I think he's fabulous. And I understand he may be a forum speaker in the next little while. Yeah. So I'm really excited. Now, of course, if you wanted to go a little further, right, you need education for girls, but you also need them not to be pulled out of school at age 14 to be married to a 35-year-old, right? You know, that just kind of clinches it as far as the girl ever being empowered in her life. So if we could marry that, literally marry that to some sort of way to pay the families to not get the girls married until they were a little older and they stood on their feet as an adult. Boy, what a tremendous 1-2 punch that would be for women's rights in Afghanistan and Central Asia.
Going off that point, do you think that educational policies are the most powerful when it comes to equality between genders?
I think you've got to have education, but you also have to have later marriage for women. And anything that you can do to mitigate patrilocality helps too. you got to understand, when a girl is married, you know, there's some places in the world where girls are married at age 8, but the, you know, if you took an average of when girls are married throughout the world, you're talking somewhere between 14 and 16 is still the average age of marriage for girls in the world, right? And she goes to her husband's compound, which is usually a patrilocal, patrilineal compound, in which there may be several generations of men and several male siblings all living together, right? She has no standing in that household. Structurally speaking, that woman has been made utterly powerless, right? And she doesn't even begin to gain any power until she has her own son, and he grows up, and he can be her advocate. And so education, but breaking the early marriage pattern for girls and trying to mitigate patrilocality. If you were asking me my first wish list, I would also say prohibit polygamy, because polygamy, I've done studies that have shown that polygamy goes hand in hand with authoritarianism and terrorism. Right? It creates inherently an unstable society, because you have elite men who have access to women, and then you have disenfranchised men who have no access to women and cannot form a household. What a stupid way to try and achieve national stability, right? So that would be my first wish list then. Education of women, later marriage for girls, mitigate patrilocality, prohibit polygamy. That would be my four-step, what did Stephen Covey say? My four-step approach to ending world conflict. There you go.
Excuse me, we have time for one more question if there's any other questions. Yeah.
So with the issue of patrilocality and question number three, do you think it's important then to focus on the cultural traditions of, you know, males getting all the inheritance and women? Because I feel like that's a huge part of that. One of the reasons.
That's very, very insightful of you.
So is that another thing that needs to be mitigated, you think?
Yeah.
Or is that a bottom-up type thing? I don't know how you would really implement that.
You're right. I think there would be some. The issue is, how do you change from a patrilocal clan setting to getting these couples independent households? It really, you know, that old advice in Genesis, therefore shall a man leave his mother and father and cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. See that? Leave his mother and father. See, right there, we have a divine condemnation of patrilocality, right? But when independent households started, all right, they started because there were different ways, even better ways, of achieving financial and economic security if you did not go the patrilocal route, right? So if you, in Northwestern Europe, it was sons and daughters, right, who went to the city and found they could make a living, right, in wage employment, as versus staying on the farm, right? That's what started the tradition of independent households for newly married couples. I think that's the way to go.
And so with that, though, it's kind of hard with a lot of families, from what I've seen, is that they want the girls to stay at home, and they need to do stuff in the home,
and they
need to
safeguard their virginity, et cetera, et cetera.
They all go stay. Okay.
That's right. Good. Well done. Well done.
Thank you for your question, and especially we'd like to thank Dr. Hudson for coming in presenting.
Appreciate it.
Just for your information, this will be posted on the Women's Research website probably by tomorrow, and if not on Monday, and that's at wri.byu.edu. So if you need to refer to some things that she discussed, that's our freedom.
Yeah.